Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a really fascinating and honestly pretty intricate subject, sociobiology, and how it sheds light on sex and gender.
Definitely complex stuff.
Right. And you, our listener, you're probably looking to get a solid grasp on these topics without getting totally bogged down in, you know, excessive detail.
And that's exactly what we're aiming for.
We've got a stack of scientific articles, research papers, and our mission really is to pull out the most crucial insights, how biology, environment, and culture all kind of weave together.
Yeah, how they shape our social behaviors, how we understand sex, our experiences of gender. We've looked at a whole range of work on the biological, the social roots of behavior and identity.
So the goal is extracting those core ideas, how our biology, the world around us, the societies we build, how they all interact.
Exactly. To influence our social lives, our perceptions of sex, and, you know, what gender means to each of us individually.
Okay, let's jump right in them. Sociobiology. At its heart, what are we talking about here?
Well, fundamentally, it's about studying the biological foundations of social behavior and looking at how evolution has shaped those behaviors over, well, millennia.
One point that jumped out at me was this idea that we're sort of biologically adapted to the Ice Age. That sounds wild.
It does sound a bit strange at first, yeah. But the idea is that those long periods of our evolutionary history left a really deep imprint. Civilization has changed incredibly fast, especially in the last 10,000 years, right?
Right, incredibly fast.
But some of our fundamental tendencies, the underlying wiring, might still reflect those much older conditions.
And part of that wiring is this internal conflict, like a drive for dominance versus resisting being dominated.
Exactly. It's this inherent push and pull within us, a kind of biological balancing act. Mm. We see echoes of a drive for dominance, like many primates. But there's also this really strong resistance to being, you know, on the receiving end.
And that tension shapes our social lives.
It shapes so much of our social dynamic. Yeah, this constant interplay.
Okay, this is where it gets really interesting for me. Sometimes customs or taboos that seem totally irrational, they might actually have logical roots, biologically speaking.
That's one of the most fascinating parts, yeah. When you consider how genes, environment, and culture interact, take that example from some West African cultures. The taboo against eating yams during the rainy season.
Right. Why would that exist? Seems arbitrary.
Well, it raises the question, doesn't it? What could be the underlying reason? Turns out this region has a high prevalence of sickle cell anemia. It's a genetic condition affecting red blood cells.
Okay.
But here's the twist. Having one copy of the sickle cell gene actually gives some protection against malaria.
Which is a huge threat there, especially during the rainy season.
Exactly. So the gene is kind of a double-edged sword.
Okay, so where did the yams fit in?
This is the cultural link. Yams, which are harvested around the start of the rainy season but often eaten later, contain a substance that actually helps combat some effects of sickle cell anemia. So the taboo against eating them during the rainy season, when malaria risk is highest, it inadvertently means people aren't counteracting the protective effect of the sickle cell trait right when they need it most.
So the cultural rule boosts malaria resistance in the population.
Potentially, yeah. It seems connected to survival in that specific environment, not just some random rule. It's a cultural practice with a possible life-saving biological consequence.
That's incredible. It just shows how tangled up biology and culture can be. You had another example too, right? Something about Andean farmers and stars.
That's right, yeah. Farmers high up in the Andes. They've traditionally used the brightness of the Pleiades star cluster, you know, the seven sisters around the June solstice, to decide when to plant potatoes.
And their predictions are good, based on stars.
Surprisingly accurate, yeah.
How does that even work? How can star brightness tell you about weather on the ground months later?
Well, at that altitude, the clarity of the stars is affected by thin, high-altitude cirrus clouds. And those clouds are more likely to form when the El Nino ocean current is stronger. A strong El Nino in June often means drought conditions later, during the growing season.
No way. So dim stars mean more clouds, which means stronger El Nino, which means likely drought. So plant earlier.
Exactly. If the stars seem dimmer, it signals a higher chance of drought and they adjust their planting time.
Yeah.
It's this amazing, like, local environmental observation encoded into a cultural practice.
Wow. Okay, so these seemingly odd traditions can make a lot of sense when you dig down. But what about really extreme examples? You mentioned Aztec cannibalism. How does that fit?
It is a very stark example, yeah. Some researchers have proposed that the Aztec practice of ritual cannibalism, I mean, sacrificing and consuming thousands of people, might have been linked, in part, to nutritional deficiencies.
Nutritional deficiencies?
Yeah, unlike many other big civilizations, the Aztecs didn't really have significant domesticated animals for food. So the theory draws a parallel to Jane Goodall's observations of chimpanzees. She noted increased aggression, even warfare, among chimp groups with poor diets.
So a lack of protein could potentially fuel that kind of intense violence.
It's one possible interpretation sociobiology offers. It's complex, obviously. But it's really important to stress that not every taboo or custom has such a neat, rational, biological explanation.
Right. Like black cats.
Exactly. Superstitions like black cats. I mean, maybe historically cats carried diseases, sure, but the specific fear of black cats probably doesn't have a strong biological basis. Some things are just, you know, cultural quirks that hang around.
Gotcha. Some things are just cultural. So you mentioned E.O. Wilson and this hierarchy of sciences. Where does sociobiology slot into that?
Right. So in Wilson's view, you can imagine sciences building on each other. You start with the basics like cell biology, cytology, then move up through neurophysiology, psychology, animal behavior study, ethology.
And then?
Then comes sociobiology or behavioral ecology, and then finally population biology. So sociobiology acts as this kind of bridge connecting individual behavior to what we see happening at the population level.
And the core idea is about genes and survival, reproductive success.
Precisely. The fundamental principle is that natural selection favors genotypes and individuals' genetic makeup that increase their chances of surviving and, crucially, reproducing. E. Wilson, famous for his work on ants and social insects, was key in establishing this field.
Sometimes called behavioral ecology, too, right?
Yeah, or evolutionary ecology. It often involves using mathematical models to figure out the best strategies for animals in different situations.
But it's not saying there's, like, a gene for being nice or a gene for being aggressive. It's not that simple.
Absolutely not. That's a common misconception. Sociobiology looks at the link between traits and behaviors and reproductive success. It's not about genes directly controlling behavior in some rigid, deterministic way.
The environment matters, too.
Hugely. The environment shapes which genes get favored over time. There's no strict genetic determinism. Genes provide possibilities, sort of blueprint, but the environment really influences how that blueprint gets expressed.
You had that example with the PAH gene. Remind us how that works.
Sure. So the PAH gene makes an enzyme that breaks down an amino acid called phenylalanine. Different versions or alleles of the gene work differently. Some make a less effective enzyme.
Leading to phenylketonuria, right?
PKU. Yeah. Exactly. A buildup of phenylalanine, which causes this genetic disorder. But even here, it's not absolute genetic control. If someone with those gene versions follows a diet low in phenylalanine,
the environmental factor, diet.
Right. The diet can largely counteract the negative effects of the genes.
So nature loads the gun, nurture pulls the trigger, or maybe nature provides the starting ingredients, nurture is the recipe.
That's a good way to think about it. Okay, now let's think about social structures. Forming groups obviously has big survival advantages. Mm. Humans have this strong tribal instinct, right?
Yes.
A tendency to form in groups.
Leading to conformity.
Often, yeah. Which can be good for group cohesion. And it's interesting, researchers looking at the Kung people in the Kalahari Desert saw that when they transitioned from hunter-gatherer life to agriculture, they observed a rapid development of stricter gender roles and male dominance, seemingly within just one generation. It shows how fast environmental shifts can impact social organization.
Wow. Okay, what about altruism? Helping others sometimes at a cost to yourself. That seems to fly in the face of survival of the fittest, doesn't it?
That's a central puzzle in sociobiology, yeah. Darwin himself grappled with it. He mostly thought evolution acted on individuals.
But things like ant colonies.
Exactly. Insect societies, where individuals sacrifice themselves for the colony. That suggests selection might also happen at the group level, or maybe among relatives, kin selection.
But then you see things like lions killing cubs.
Right, or infanticide in primates. It makes it clear that ultimately propagating one's own genes is usually the bottom line. The general idea now is that selection acts more strongly on the genotype, the genetic blueprint, than the outward phenotype, the characteristics you see.
So evolution has come up with different ways to explain altruism.
Yeah, Robert Trivers, a really influential biologist, proposed several key ideas. There's kin selection. We help relatives because they share our genes.
Makes sense.
Then reciprocal altruism. I help you now, you help me later. Builds cooperation.
Like a favor bank.
Sort of, yeah. There's also competitive altruism. Being helpful signals your status or resources. And even altruism is a handicap. Doing something costly shows you're so fit you can afford it.
So these selfless acts might actually have hidden benefits for the individual doing them?
Often, yes, from an evolutionary perspective. And these behaviors get tangled up with our subjective interpretations, our belief systems, ideas about reward, fairness, empathy. They reinforce these actions, even if the immediate payback isn't obvious.
Okay, now you said xenophobia is the flip side of altruism. How does that work?
Well, xenophobia, the fear or distrust of outsiders, can be seen as the other side of that in-group loyalty coin. Our biology seems to predispose us, to some extent, to identify more strongly with people like us.
Leading to us versus them.
Yeah. Throughout history, that's often resulted in a strong us versus them mentality. Outsiders are perceived as potential threats. Arnie Toshfell's work in social psychology showed how easily these group divisions form.
And what about social hierarchies, castes, marginalized groups, and tolerance? Where does that fit in evolutionarily?
Social hierarchies are complex constructions, for sure. It's only relatively recently, really, with globalization and more interaction, that ideas like universal tolerance, human rights, appreciating biodiversity, that these have gained broader traction.
Historically, it was more about your own group.
Often, yeah. Tribal societies frequently focused on their own specific gods, which builds cohesion within the group, but can definitely create divisions and conflict between groups.
Let's talk aggression. Is it just a basic instinct we all have, something we're born with?
It's way more complex than just a single aggression instinct. People like Freud or Conrad Lorenz talked about instinctual drives, sure. But the modern view is much more nuanced. It's highly context dependent.
So aggression can be useful sometimes.
It can be beneficial in specific situations, yeah. Securing territory, getting food, competing for mates. Think about the Maori in New Zealand. Historically, honor and revenge were huge, leading to frequent tribal wars.
And the arrival of firearms.
Had a devastating impact, initially amplifying the violence. But eventually, the cultural focus on those traditional forms of aggression changed. The role of specific genes, like that MAOA mutation, the so-called warrior gene, that's still being researched, but it's really problematic to say a single gene causes aggression.
It's an interaction again. Biology and environment.
Exactly. It's always an interaction.
What about religion? How does that fit into our evolutionary story?
Religions, like societies, evolve. They often play a huge role in strengthening group bonds, shared symbols, rituals, beliefs. They unify within a group.
But can divide between groups.
Unfortunately, yes.
What?
That potential is always there. Psychology experiments show how ridiculously easy it is to create groups and get people favoring their own, even based on nothing important. Robert Sapolsky's work digs into the biology of this us versus them stuff.
And religious ceremonies and myths.
Ceremonies reinforce group importance, mark time. Myths provide simple frameworks where we came from, our place in the cosmos. But it's crucial to remember our modern view isn't universal. Lots of hunter-gatherer groups don't have a concept of a single, high, interventionist god.
And the type of gods might even relate to the environment.
There are theories, yeah.
Yeah.
Like maybe unpredictable environments lead to polytheism, lots of capricious gods, while more stable places or societies often at war might favor monotheism, a single, powerful, perhaps more paternalistic figure.
It's also interconnected. Okay, shifting to more personal stuff. Sex. You mentioned human sexual customs are kind of weird compared to other mammals.
They really are, yeah.
Yeah.
Jared Diamond talks about this in Why We Like Sex. Humans generally have sex in private. Females don't have obvious signs of fertility like estrus. Males don't lactate. Women go through menopause. These are all quite unusual in the mammal world.
Why are we so different?
Likely complex reasons tied to our unique social structures, our incredibly long childhood development, and the vital importance of pair bonding for raising those helpless kids.
And incest taboos. They seem universal.
Pretty much universal, yeah. And the biological basis is strong, avoiding the much higher risk of genetic disorders when close relatives reproduce. There also seems to be an evolved aversion, the Westermarck effect, to sexual feelings towards people you grew up with very closely.
Fascinating how biology underpins so much of what feels purely cultural or personal. But are there limits to what we can learn or change?
Oh, definitely. Our learning isn't infinite. We tend to learn things more easily if they were relevant to our ancestors' survival. Look at superstitions. They can stick around for ages. That's studied in memetics, how ideas spread like viruses.
So some ideas are just sticky.
Very sticky, yeah. And we're prone to cognitive illusions, like the Monty Hall problem. Our thinking isn't always perfectly rational, especially when things are counterintuitive. Plus, we naturally see the world through our own cultural lens that trances familiarity. though new generations often adapt to things that seemed bizarre before.
Sociobiology offers amazing insights, but you said it faced criticism too. What were the main issues?
Yeah, despite its explanatory power, there were criticisms. One is testability. It's hard to run experiments on evolution that happened thousands of years ago.
Makes sense.
There were also worries about creating scientific mythology, oversimplifying biological explanations, maybe using them to justify social inequalities, which wasn't the intention.
And misunderstanding.
Huge misunderstanding sometimes. Critics often accused it of promoting rigid genetic determinism, which wasn't what Wilson and others were saying. It's crucial to get that finding biological influences doesn't excuse bad behavior or mean things can't change. The goal is explanation. Ideally simple, but not too simple. Acknowledging the nature-nurture interplay.
Right, it's always complex. Okay, let's shift gears a bit. You mentioned a systemic approach earlier, RDOC. What's that about?
RDOC, yeah. Research Domain Criteria. It's a project the National Institute of Mental Health started back in 2009. It's basically a new way to think about and research mental disorders.
How does it differ from, say, the DSM?
Instead of grouping disorders based only on symptoms, RDOC tries to understand the underlying systems in the brain. It integrates info from genes, molecules, brain circuits, all the way up to behavior. It's trying to get at the mechanisms.
So instead of just anxiety disorder, RDOC looks at the specific brain circuits involved in fear or threat processing.
Exactly. It identifies six main functional domains. Negative valence systems think fear, loss. Positive valence systems reward, motivation. Cognitive systems attention, memory. Social processes, communication, understanding others, arousal regulatory systems, sleep, stress, and sensorimotor systems, movement, habits.
That's comprehensive.
The goal is to build these complex models, sometimes called neurocognitive phenomics, linking all those levels. And connectomics is a big part of that, mapping the brain's connections.
Like the Human Connectome Project, mapping all the wires.
Exactly. Mapping both the physical structure using MRI and the functional connections, which areas fire together using fMRI.
Is it all just about how strong the connections are? Does everything boil down to the wiring diagram?
That's a great question. And the answer is probably no. Not just the connections, the way individual neurons work, the role of glial support cells, even the blood supply system, they all likely play crucial roles too. How they all interact with the network is still a huge area of research.
Okay, let's dive into a big one. Sex and brains. We know there are biological differences between male and female bodies, obviously. What about our brains?
Well, first, even the idea of sex being strictly binary biologically. It gets complicated when you look closely. Some organisms can even change sex.
Right.
But in mammals and birds, we see different behaviors between sexes, which strongly implies brain differences. Like songbirds, their brain structures actually change during mating season to help with singing and attracting mates.
The brain physically changes for mating. That relates back to sexual selection, right? Signaling good genes.
Precisely. Sexual selection drives those traits, beauty, strength, songs in males that signal genetic quality. Remember the handicap principle?
The peacock's tail.
Yeah. A costly trait that signals, I'm so fit, I can survive despite this burden. And in birds, you see lots of monogamy. Probably because raising chicks is hard work. Needing both parents. Trust is key.
So displays signal fitness. We see amazing courtship rituals too, right? Bowerbirds?
Oh yeah, bowerbirds building elaborate structures, decorating them.
Yeah.
Or those Darwin bark spiders building huge webs. They showcase fitness, intelligence, resourcefulness.
Okay, but in humans, why is it often said that females are the beautiful sex? Seems like a reversal from the peacock example.
That is a really interesting point, and it does seem like a bit of a reversal. One idea is that social intelligence became incredibly important for females during human evolution, pregnancy, childbirth, raising very dependent infants.
And fathers became more important, too, with long childhoods.
Exactly. So the reversal, women often valuing resources and stability alongside looks, men often valuing youth and fertility cues, likely reflects really complex evolutionary trade-offs. Think about intelligence needing a bigger skull versus bipedalism needing a narrower pelvis for running.
These trade-offs shaped our whole evolution.
Absolutely. Survival depended on endurance, cooperation, shared childcare, and stable pair bonds. Sex appeal itself probably evolved partly to encourage those bonds.
Because kids take so long to mature.
Right. You need stable families. Culture reinforces it, marriage, laws. But biology reinforces it too. Jealousy, sex used for bonding, not just procreation. Misunderstanding that evolutionary purpose, reducing sex only to making babies, has caused a lot of problems historically.
Let's get into the brain biology. How do hormones shape brain sex?
Hormones are crucial, starting very early, around week 6 in the embryo. The sort of default developmental path seems to be female. It's the action of male hormones, mainly testosterone, which gets converted to estrogen in parts of the brain that leads to brain masculinization.
And this happens at specific times.
Yes, during critical periods of brain growth and reorganization. Big ones around age 2, age 6, but changes continue subtly, even into our 20s.
So it's not just XX or XY chromosomes fixing everything?
Definitely not. Animal studies, like with rat pups, show instinctive behavioral differences. Males explore more, females seek shelter more. But if you manipulate hormones during fetal development, you can actually reverse those behaviors.
Showing hormones organize the brain early on.
Seems that way, yeah. And similar hormonal disruptions can happen in humans, potentially leading to intersex conditions where chromosomes, gonads, or anatomy don't fit typical male-female boxes, sometimes called hermaphroditism. It's rarer in humans than some other species, but more common than many think.
How were intersex people viewed historically?
It varied hugely. Ancient Greeks had myths like Hermaphroditus, sometimes seeing it as special. But later, Judeo-Christian traditions often condemned it as unnatural. Ancient Rome even debated their legal status because men and women had different rights.
So external appearance doesn't always match genetics or hormones?
Not at all. Yeah. You can have XY females, XX males. Conditions like Turner syndrome or adrenogenital syndrome affect sex development too. The key thing is hormones heavily influence brain structure related to sex, and outward appearance doesn't always define genetics or, importantly, gender identity.
And female hormones, estrogen, progesterone?
They have wide-ranging effects, metabolism, mood, cycles. Oxytocin, the bonding hormone, seems to amplify existing emotions, good or bad.
Other hormonal differences?
Yeah, the hypothalamus-pituitary system differs. Men's hormone regulation tends to be more stable. Women's is cyclical. There's that 2D point 4D finger ratio idea, the index to ring finger length, potentially linked to prenatal androgen exposure and maybe attractiveness. Those studies are often limited.
What about aggression, nurturing?
We see average differences. Male aggression levels might link to prenatal androgens. Impulsivity often correlates with testosterone. Cortisol affects aggression, appetite, stress responses. And then there's the Cuvade syndrome in some expectant fathers. Hormonal shifts, pregnancy-like symptoms, possibly linked to bonding.
You mentioned a third sex or non-binary identities fitting into this biological view.
Right. While true biological hermaphroditism, both functional sets of organs, is super rare in humans, the biological reality is clearly more complex than just male-female. Many cultures, historically and today, recognize third genders or non-binary people.
Examples.
The Muxes in Mexico, Gavinoches in the Dominican Republic, Native American Two-Spirit people, Hijras in India, traditions across the Pacific, Africa. Some countries like India, Pakistan, now legally recognize a third gender on official documents, and more countries are adding non-binary options.
So gender is different from biological sex.
Absolutely. Gender is more of a psychological construct. It's about your subjective sense of self, your identity, your social role. It might align with your assigned sex at birth, or it might not. It's influenced by culture, but not solely determined by biology.
They're separate things. Biological sex, sexual preference, gender identity.
Exactly. They're distinct aspects of who someone is. Just look at the options on Facebook now. It shows the spectrum people identify with.
And gender roles. That's the cultural part.
That's the cultural part, yeah. Mm-hmm. The expectations, behaviors a society associates with being male or female. And these very hugely matriarchal, patriarchal, egalitarian societies all have different ideas. The debates around gender balance and jobs, politics, that's part of this ongoing negotiation of roles beyond the old binary.
What about gender expression, how you show your gender?
That's how you outwardly present your identity, clothes, hair, mannerisms. Someone identifying as male might express themselves femininely, or a woman might express masculinely. It can correlate with sexual orientation sometimes, but it's separate from identity and attraction. Think of music. Tastes huge variety in both what you like and how you express that liking.
And gender dysphoria. That's the distress from a mismatch?
Yes. Gender dysphoria is the clinical term for the significant distress caused by that incongruence between gender identity and assigned sex. Support can range from therapy helping someone align with their assigned sex to hormone therapy or gender transition surgery for others.
There's the social construct theory of gender, too.
Right. Emphasizing societal influence. But critics like Steven Pinker argue you can't ignore the biological factors even if they're complex and we don't fully understand the interplay. Media discussions often oversimplify this, unfortunately.
So biology sets limits, maybe, but lots of variation is possible within them.
That seems likely, yeah. Kind of like the nature versus nurture debate for personality. Biology provides a foundation, but experience and culture build on it.
Politicians sometimes use gender ideology as a negative term.
Yeah, it's often used vaguely, sometimes just as a way to dismiss discussions about LGBTQ+ rights or gender diversity. It's important to remember the statistics here. Gender dysphoria is real, and the high rates of mental health issues and suicide attempts among transgender youth are deeply concerning.
Though the causes are complex.
Very complex, yes. And challenges can sadly persist even after transition for some individuals. It highlights the need for support and understanding.
You also mentioned identities like asexual, xenogender.
Right. Asexual individuals experience little or no sexual attraction, and it's a spectrum, with communities like Avian providing support. This leads to subcultures forming around identities. Xenogender is a non-binary identity defined outside the male-female binary, often using metaphors like animals or concepts. There are others, too, like otherkin.
It shows how specific environments, like online communities, can foster diverse identities.
Definitely. But it's crucial to distinguish gender identity from paraphilia's atypical sexual interests. Paraphilias are only considered problematic if they cause distress or harm. Gender identity and sexual orientation aren't viewed as medical deviations in the same way, though cultural views differ.
And legal recognition is catching up. Genderless people, neutral pronouns.
Slowly, yes. Australia recognized Alex McFarlane as neither male nor female early on. Pronouns like Z and here are gaining traction. Transgender, remember, is identifying differently from assigned sex at birth.
The idea that gender is purely cultural, the blank slate idea, has caused harm, hasn't it?
Immense harm. The David Reimer case is a tragic example. Trying to force a gender identity against someone's internal sense failed catastrophically. It really showed the importance of understanding the biological underpinnings, leading places like Johns Hopkins to change their approach to surgeries on intersex infants. Biology matters.
Okay, let's move on to sexual orientation. Clearly, not just straight or gay, right? It's a spectrum.
Absolutely a spectrum. Surveys, things like the Epstein Sexual Orientation Inventory, consistently show that very few people are exclusively heterosexual or exclusively homosexual in their attractions and feelings. Most people fall somewhere in between.
Why would evolution allow for a spectrum?
Good question. Maybe nature just experiments with variation. Or maybe non-reproductive orientations had other benefits. In some animal groups with limited female access, male homosexuality might reduce conflict or provide practice. Bisexuality is common too, like in bonobos.
And science now sees homosexuality as natural variation.
Yes. It was wrongly classified as a mental disorder in the DSM, but that was removed back in 1973 based on evidence. So-called conversion therapies are ineffective and harmful. Think of Alan Turing's tragic story. Major mental health organizations worldwide agree. Homosexuality isn't a disorder. It's a natural variation seen across the animal kingdom.
So there's a biological basis.
Strong evidence points that way. Prenatal hormone exposure seems to play a role. There are observed neuroanatomical differences, like in the hypothalamus, between gay and straight individuals. Genetic and epigenetic links are also being found. Female sexuality often appears less binary, too.
What about evolutionary advantages? The helpful uncle idea.
Right, the idea that non-reproducing individuals might help raise relatives' offspring, boosting shared genes indirectly. Or maybe it helps with social bonding or practice in some species. Importantly, there's zero link between sexual orientation and nurturing ability. Gay couples want to adopt and are great parents. Studies show kids thrive. We even see gay animal pairs caring for orphans.
Is it genetic then?
Not fully heritable like eye color, but genetics play a significant role. Twin studies show that pretty clearly. Maybe the optimal percentage of different orientations varies depending on the ecosystem or social structure for a species. Societal attitudes have changed hugely over time, too.
So the percentage reporting might change, but the underlying biology is consistent across species.
Homosexual behavior is documented in hundreds of animal species, yeah. It serves different functions, maybe.
But the argument, there's no single gay gene, so it's not biological. That's flawed.
Deeply flawed. Complex traits are almost never due to a single gene. It's always multiple genes interacting with environment. Large studies have found chromosome regions, like on 8 and XQ28, and specific genetic variations associated with male sexual orientation. But no single gay gene, no. It's likely a mix of genes, prenatal environment, hormones.
And it's not caused by upbringing.
No evidence for that at all. It's not contagious, not learned. Being raised by gay parents just fosters understanding, not orientation. Sadly, the higher rates of suicidal thoughts among non-heterosexual people are strongly linked to homophobia discrimination, not the orientation itself. The science points to accepting sexual diversity as natural.
Okay, let's shift to average differences between women and men, beyond orientation. This comes up a lot.
Right, and it's crucial to stress average differences. We measure these using distribution curves, standard deviations. Individuals vary hugely.
What are some observed average cognitive differences?
Okay, on average, women tend to show advantages in linguistic skills, faster language acquisition, word generation, some numerical tests needing detail, manual dexterity, recognizing overall similarities, spotting missing things. Also, higher average empathy and cooperation reported.
And men, on average?
Men tend to score higher on spatial orientation tasks, mentally rotating objects, throwing accuracy, some mathematical and geometric reasoning. And autism rates are nearly 4 times higher in males, sometimes seen as an extreme male brain profile. Personality studies also show surprisingly little overlap between typical male and female profiles on some measures.
What about brain function or structure underlying these averages?
Research suggests brain damage can affect men and women differently, implying less distinct specialization between hemispheres in women or different localization. Some functions like spelling grammar might be more localized in women, though. The back part of the corpus callosum, the splenium, is often larger in adult women.
Women have more connections between hemispheres.
Generally show greater interhemispheric integration, yeah. Might explain why left hemisphere damage impacts spooch less often in women than men. Conversely, right hemisphere damage might hit men harder cognitively sometimes, the smaller corpus callosum in men. Maybe it helps tasks needing intense focus within one hemisphere, like map reading. Pure speculation, though.
And things like coordination, emotion.
Stronger bimanual coordination in women. Maybe linked to more female violinists. Piano needs more independent hands. Emotion processing seems more distributed across both hemispheres in women, more right hemisphere dominant in men, perhaps linking to women often finding it easier to verbalize feelings.
Right.
Abstract tasks tend to light up the right hemisphere in men, both in women.
So female intuition, could it relate to this brain integration, better linking of verbal, visual, emotional cues?
It's a plausible hypothesis. Maybe better integration allows for picking up subtle cues, integrating different kinds of information more holistically. Women do tend to score higher on sensitivity to sensory and nonverbal cues, while men might average higher on prioritizing hierarchy rules. The biggest differences are often seen during development, leading some researchers like Kimura to link it to hormones like estrogen and even suggest separate schooling might be beneficial.
What about large-scale brain scan studies?
Big studies comparing thousands of brains show women, despite slightly smaller average brain size, have higher white matter density and density in many subcortical areas. More complex cortical folding, too, especially front and parietal lobes, giving similar surface area.
And connectome studies, the wiring maps.
A major study by Ingel Halikar et al. On almost 1,000 young people found distinct average patterns. Male brains showed denser connections within hemispheres and lobes, optimized for perception action, sensory motor coordination, more localized modules.
And female brains.
Denser connections between the two hemispheres, facilitating integration of analytical left brain processing with intuitive right brain processing, perhaps optimizing memory, language, social cognition.
And these structural differences matched behavioral differences in the study.
Yes, generally. Women better on attention, word-face memory, social cognition tests. Men better on spatial tasks, motor speed, perception action. The connectome differences seem pretty undeniable, though the debate about their cognitive meaning will go on.
It's a complex area, easily influenced by ideology.
Very much so. Gender studies faces that challenge. Humans can mask or override biological preferences, sure, but those predispositions likely exist, as Pinker argued. We shouldn't ignore biology, even while acknowledging upbringing and society are hugely impactful.
And always remember, these are averages, not destinies.
Crucially, individual variation is massive. Forcing equal representation everywhere might waste natural talents if interests and aptitudes differ on average. The brain is plastic, but not infinitely so. It's funny how late science came to study biology's influence on mind. Maybe a bias towards spirit over matter. And equality before the law doesn't mean we're all biologically identical.
Lots to think about. As we wrap up, any final concluding thoughts from this deep dive?
Well, broadly, ignorance often leads to bad outcomes, right? Knowledge can bring acceptance, think left-handedness, sexual orientation. Maybe understanding aggression better leads to treatment, prevention, not just punishment. Though brain interventions raise tricky ethical questions about the purpose of punishment, revenge, or rehab.
Before we finish, let's do some quick, interesting trivia related to all this.
Okay. Incest taboos, biologically based on risk of genetic disease. Non-universal taboos can arise culturally. Like in San Antero, Colombia, there's a weird donkey festival context where some zoophilia reportedly occurs, possibly linked to past oral history. Albania has sworn virgins, women living as men. Media reports on how often students think about sex show huge variation. And those Tegradera beetles, their mating can look gentle or brutal, but it's about transferring a protective chemical, cantharidin, to the female's eggs.
Wow, some really diverse examples there. Thanks so much for guiding us through all of this complex territory. It's been incredibly insightful.
My pleasure. It's fascinating stuff.
So that brings us to the end of this deep dive into biology, culture, sex, and gender. We've seen how interconnected everything is. Understanding these factors really does give valuable insights into why we behave as we do and how our societies work.
And hopefully it sparked more questions for you, the listener. There's always more to explore.
Definitely. We encourage you to keep digging into these fascinating topics.
And maybe leave you with this thought. How could a deeper grasp of these biological and social influences actually reshape our norms? Maybe foster more acceptance, more understanding of the incredible diversity of human experience.